In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
Welcome to the new phase of global warming, global freezing. I guess all those doomers back in the 1970s who said that a new ice age was coming in 10 years if we don't do something were right. They were just off by 40 years. Today we'll be talking about the weather and real forecasting along with real consequences, because when flawed science is the backbone of policy decisions, you're going to get bad decisions. Garbage science in, garbage policies out. Policy decisions are based on what policy experts tell politicians, and politicians then have to decide what to do based on that advice. The problem is if you only use the accepted experts, and if everyone is telling you the same thing, you're going to believe it. Are you a climate scientist, a computer scientist, a medical doctor? Do you even have a science background? If you're a typical politician, no to all of that. That's why we've talked previously about the tyranny of the experts. Because government has gotten so big, politicians are enslaved to the opinions of experts. Government now has its grubby little tentacles into every aspect of society. And because government controls more of your life, more of the economy, more of everything, governors and presidents and every other politician have to rely on outside experts because they themselves are not experts in the thousands of fields the government now controls. Except what happens is politicians aren't really in charge because they do whatever the experts tell them to do. When the power goes out, it's not just the politician's fault, it's the fault of the experts pulling their strings. And generally, it's the experts with the most money behind them. Except, ironically, the experts have the most money behind them because politicians gave that money to them. And that's the real problem, because we're never going to get out of this until politicians stop paying experts to tell the politicians how to spend money on the experts' issues. It's not just circular reasoning, it's circular spending. You know, a bit like watching water go down the drain. I'd like to welcome Myron Ebel back to the show. He was raised in Eastern Oregon, where they make him right, and he is now the director of the Center for Energy and Environment at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. He also chairs the Cooler Heads Coalition, which with representatives from more than two dozen nonprofit organizations in both the U.S. and abroad that challenge global warming alarmism and oppose energy rationing policies. Myron, it's great to talk to you again.
It's great to be with you, Mark. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'd like to kind of start our time with you with sort of an overview of energy and the environment and what's going on. America is, for the moment anyway, energy independent. We're a net exporter of oil for the first time in decades. Do you think that's going to come to a screeching halt under Biden? Or as we've seen with other issues, can Biden's hands be tied up in court to stop him from stopping oil and natural gas?
President Biden promised during the campaign that everything that Trump did, he would be moving in the opposite direction on energy and climate. Mm. So to the extent that the president, without getting legislation through Congress, which is going to be a problem for him, but not impossible on some things, to the extent that he can do things through executive action, I think, yes, things will be very different under the Biden-Harris administration than under President Trump. On energy, you know, he said that everything is going to be about climate, that every department of the government is going to be about climate first and foremost. So they've got climate advisors and climate programs in the Department of the Treasury, the Department of Defense. I mean, we could go down the list. So yes, I think we're looking at a world where it's back to the Obama administration on energy issues, but worse, much more radical.
Mm. Well, we've already seen the price of oil. It's gone from $37 a barrel at election time in November 2020 to over $60 a barrel in just, you know, 3 months' time here. On the environmental side, with this massive cold wave that has engulfed pretty much the entire continental U.S. except for Florida, Do you think people have seen all that and are beginning to question the theory of global warming? And if so, could that give some pause to those who want to spend $100 trillion on the Paris Climate Accord?
Well, of course, the global warming alarmists, 10, 15 years ago, were all saying, well, you know, snow will be a thing of the past for places yes. that have snow. And then when that didn't happen, then they started coming up with explanations, which is, well, you know, severe weather events aren't just heat. They're also cold and big storms. And we're, you know, global warming is going to cause more severe weather events of all kinds. Well, of course, that's actually nonsense. And the better scientists among them know that.
Right.
Global warming means less severe weather, fewer and less severe or less intense severe weather events. And that's because winter storms come when big masses of cold air come down from the north, from the Arctic, and hit warmer air masses coming up from the tropics. That's when you get these big severe weather events in the winter. And so if it's warmer in the Arctic, the big air mass coming down from the Arctic is not as cold, and that means that when it hits the warm air from the tropics, you're not going to have as an intense an event. So, the fact that we're still having very severe blizzards after we were told that they're going to be a thing of the past, I think should cause people to question global warming alarmism. But I, you know, they have the climate industrial complex has such resources in terms of money and power that they are going to continue to push that anything that happens weather-wise, anything bad that happens weather-wise, well, that's exactly what we'd expect because of climate change.
Yeah,
what they're going to say.
Sure. I'd like to see those computer models that 10 years ago when the world was supposed to end. Did they predict all of this ice and snow today? So one thing real quick, only got about a minute with you here. The Keystone Pipeline, Biden, his first day in office, blocked the permit for Keystone. Meanwhile, he is now pushing a pipeline for the Taliban to bring oil from Turkmenistan through Taliban territory into India. I thought pipelines were bad, and yet we're doing it for the Taliban.
Well, they're bad when the environmental pressure groups tell them they're bad, and they're good when the Muslim regimes in Asia tell him that they're good. So he's
That's
a
go-along
to get-along kind of guy.
Yeah, I guess so. Okay, let's take a break here. Come back, we'll be talking about Texas and the myth of green. Stay with us. And welcome back. We're talking with Myron Ebel, who is the director of the Center for Energy and Environment at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, or CEI. CEI is a leading advocate for freedom and liberty when it comes to economic and regulatory policy issues. So, Myron, I'd like to talk to you about the big news this week, the icy cold gripping most of the country, especially in Texas, which is seeing some record-shattering cold. Our home state of Oregon also made the news when a huge ice storm knocked out power to more than 300,000 households. Texas, though, lost power to 4 million people, which is pretty much the entire state of Oregon. So, but what happened in Oregon was due to physical problems. Thanks to our hydroelectric power plants, we had plenty of power, except the ice took down trees, which then took down physical lines. What happened in Texas was very different in the sense that they had widespread outages because of the type of generators they had, wind and solar. You know, I think a lot of people had no idea, myself included, that Texas had such a huge reliance on wind and solar. How did that happen in Texas, of all places?
Mark, it started with when George W. Bush was governor. He signed into law a what's called a renewable standard for electricity, which required the utilities to provide a certain part of their power from windmills and some solar panels. But North Texas and West Texas are very windy places, so if windmills make sense anywhere, they make sense there, or probably the Columbia Gorge area east of, you know, where the wind comes in from the Pacific. That's probably another place that makes sense for windmills. So so Texas has a lot of windmills. The blackouts that have been caused by the blizzard are not entirely due to the windmills. In fact, the problem is that the entire Texas grid is designed for hot weather, not for cold weather. Hmm. Whereas in Wisconsin or Minnesota, it's designed, you know, for cold weather. So when they have big blizzards where it's much colder in Minnesota than it is in Texas now, the power plants keep running. In Texas, the windmills aren't winterized, but neither are the gas plants, the natural gas plants. So everybody took a hit. And I would say this is not directly due to the windmills, but it is due to this push for renewable power. Because the most important thing for an electric grid is that it supplies reliable power. And right. The problem with trying to put windmills into the grid or solar panels is that they're not reliable. And so that creates problems. So the regulators in Texas for the past 20 some years have been trying to keep reliability up while having more and more unreliable power from windmills. And, you know, we've now seen the consequence of that. They've failed. And they thought they were going to fail in a heat wave. And the reason is because, you know, it gets real hot in Texas in the summer, but the wind doesn't blow very much in the summer. So they have to rely on good old natural gas, coal, and nuclear in the summer. And as they've closed coal-fired power plants in Texas, they've got a thinner and thinner margin of error. The reliability cushion has gotten thinner and thinner. So what they've been concentrating on in Texas for a number of years is how to keep the lights on in the summer when everybody has their air conditioner on and the power demand goes way up when the wind isn't blowing. Well, it turns out that they still are subject to blizzards every 20 or 50 years, and they've now had one, and they found out that reliability in the winter is an even more serious problem because cold kills people. Cold weather kills people. Hot weather makes people uncomfortable and, you know, upset and annoyed and not very productive. But cold weather kills people. So they have a huge problem there now. And it's really underneath it all caused by this push that's been going on by the climate industrial complex for more and more and more renewables, which President Biden says we've got to have 100% renewables. So I would say what's happened in Texas, we could call it the Biden blackout agenda preview.
Well, in terms of how these unreliable solar and wind farms get put in the first place, is it are city and energy planners, are they convinced to go with solar and wind? Are there mandates that they have to go with solar wind? Are they cheaper and more reliable over the long run? Or is it solely due to the environmental government subsidies aspects?
Well, there's a very powerful special interest, the renewable energy industry, that has convinced over the years many state legislatures to pass renewable mandates so that to require the utility to provide a certain percentage of the power from renewable sources. And this has gotten so extreme that, you know, in California now, they have passed a mandate that by 2050 or something like that, 100% of their power has to come from non-fossil fuel sources and non-nuclear too. So that's part of it. At the other end, here in Washington, D.C., where I am, they have convinced Congress to give a subsidy for windmills and solar panels. And the purpose of the subsidy is if an electric utility in Oregon had a mandate from the state to build windmills, they wouldn't want to do that because they're too expensive. But if there's a federal subsidy, then it becomes reasonable. Hmm. So it's these two things working in action. I mean, the climate industrial complex that's been built up is huge. They have massive resources and they spend a lot of money on political lobbying. Hmm. They spend a lot of money on media to convince people that all this is a good thing. They spend a lot of money on essentially buying support. So we're reaching the reckoning point, and the Biden administration says we have to just
even more
burst past it. We have to go to 100% when in fact when a grid has more than 20% wind and solar, it starts to become very unstable, and eventually you're going to have these unreliable periods of blackout. So as I said, I think what's happened in Texas is a preview of the Biden blackout agenda.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Okay, got a big question here for you. So let's go ahead and take a break. Coming back, we'll talk a little bit more about Texas and also look at possibly some better options. Stay with us. And welcome back. We're talking today to Myron Ebel. He's the director of the Center for Energy and Environment at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. You can find out more about them and the great work they do on your behalf by heading to CEI.org. That's CEI.org. And Myron, in that last segment, we were talking about Texas. And, you know, it's not just the cold and ice that's and the electricity problems, but now they're having problems with water as well. Many cities apparently rely on electrical pumps rather than gravity-fed water towers.
Yeah.
So when they lost power, they lost water too. People, therefore, were unable to keep, you know, that little trickle of water running that you do to stop pipes from freezing. And so now there are pipes bursting in addition to no power. I mean, it is just a real mess down there. And clearly, as you said, planners essentially didn't plan for this. So here's the thing, though. Come election time, are people going to be blaming green energy that was pushed at them, or are they going to blame the elected officials who bought into solar and wind because of the subsidies dangled at them?
It's a good question. I'm sure there'll be a shoving match over who to blame, and I don't know who will win that. I think there's plenty of blame to go around, and I think the people who have the most responsibility will be the ones who will be trying to hide, you know, in the darkest corner. So,
yes.
You know, we'll have to see how it turns out. I do think this is a disaster in Texas, particularly. But I do think we need to understand that blizzards like this only happen every few decades. This big and going this far south. So, you know, there was one I forget back in the 80s that hit the East Coast and the Southeast. You know, I'm not suffering under this. I'm here in Washington D.C., which is, you know, fairly mild at the moment. We've had some snow, but not a big blizzard. So I can perhaps say, you know, I hope people will be a little bit charitable when they start passing out the blame. I mean, yeah, there are people to blame, but this is a very unusual event.
Mm. Well, so green energy is not always green. I know that you're certainly very, very aware of that. You got toxic acid lakes and radioactive soil in China that does a lot of the rare earth mining. You've got massive water pollution around cobalt and lithium mines in South America and Africa. I mean, how exactly did we get the notion that these green energies are somehow green?
The environmental movement has done a very good job at attacking energy sources where people can see them and hiding the pollution that comes from the mining in China or the Congo or somewhere else. You know, we have immense mineral resources in this country, particularly in the Southwest and the West generally. We don't do a whole lot of large-scale hard rock mining anymore. It's all been shipped to China, where, you know, they do it with, you know, forced labor, and in the Congo they do it with child labor, and they create a huge amount of pollution. Whereas if it were done in this country, it would be done in a much more environmentally rigorous way. It wouldn't create the amount of pollution. But the environmental movement has been able to say, hey, we don't need to mine things. It's ugly and dirty. Let somebody else do it where you don't have to pay attention to it. So that's, you know, the whole movement for electric vehicles is just based on that, you know, cars with gas engines have exhaust, but electric vehicles don't. But if you tie in where the parts for the electric vehicle came from and the metals that were mined to build the electric vehicle, you would see that they are very dirty.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I had read a study once that said that for every 1 ton of rare earth mined in places like China, it generates 2,000 tons of radioactive waste. That's astonishing. And I think for every windmill, they use like half a ton. So basically for every two windmills, you've got 2,000 tons of radioactive waste sitting around. So is it time to revisit investing in cleaner coal technologies. I mean, do you think places like Texas might suddenly want to look at that and actually put some money into that?
Well, you know, I think, first of all, coal is clean now. That is, modern coal-fired power plants are very clean. Now, the problem in the U.S. is that we haven't built any for a couple of 3 decades, whereas in China, they're building several each month. But modern coal technology is very clean. Now, when people say clean coal, they often mean without with some kind of carbon dioxide capture. That is, you know, the main byproduct of burning anything is oxygen is combined and turns into carbon dioxide, and that's what produces the energy. Well, if you mean coal, we should figure out how to burn coal and then somehow capture the carbon dioxide and store it somewhere or turn it into rock or whatever. I'm not too keen on that because it's very expensive. I mean, the advantage of coal is that it's an incredibly cheap source of clean energy when it's burned in modern coal-fired power plants. And the United States has the world's largest coal supplies. So the fact that we're shutting down all of our coal-fired power plants is very disturbing, I think, not only in terms of our economy, but also in terms of just using our resources. It's the cheapest form of electricity. It's incredibly reliable. And we have just an unbelievable amount of coal, particularly in Wyoming and Montana. So I'm for building new clean coal-fired power plants. I'm not as excited about some kind of how to capture the carbon dioxide. I think right. It's way too expensive, and I just don't think it will price coal out of the market.
Well, and plus you've got a lot of scientists that say that we're actually in a dearth right now of carbon dioxide. We actually need more carbon dioxide. Just real quick, about a minute here with you, what are some other solutions out there as far as energy is concerned? Is there any interest in things like small-scale nuclear reactors or some other solution?
Yes. I mean, I think we believe in innovation, and Americans have been, you know, among the most innovative people who've ever existed. So I believe in innovation. I think that there will be new energy sources and new technologies to tap energy sources, and I think small-scale nuclear might be one of them. But here's what I'd say. I'm not going to pick them because I don't know enough, and I don't think government should pick them because government has a very bad – let the market figure it out. Let market forces provide incentives. That's what happened with the shale oil and gas revolution.
Yep,
it wasn't exactly government-directed. Government didn't even know it was happening until after it was completely undone and underway. So that was the biggest energy innovation of the past 60, 70 years in the world, and it's completely transformed the American energy economy. Yeah. We were running out of natural gas, and now we just have it everywhere. So I think
I'm just going to say it once again, the solution is get government out of the way, as with energy and so many other solutions as well that are out there. Myron, unfortunately, we're up against the clock. I want to thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Mark.
I'd like to welcome Chuck Weiss back to the show. Chuck is a fearsome global warming skeptic and debunker, and he does so from a background of actual science as a trained meteorologist. Chuck, it's great to talk to you.
Glad to be back again, Mark.
Absolutely. So there was an important point that our previous guest, Myron Ebel, had brought up that I think is really going to be the framework for our discussion with you. Myron had said that the renewable energy that failed so badly in Texas when they really needed it was actually a product of George W. Bush when he was governor of Texas. He, quote-unquote, listened to the science, meaning the global warming modelers, and because he didn't understand the science but trusted the science, he went ahead and pushed through policy recommendations based on things he didn't understand. And as a result, he spent a lot of state and federal money on wind and solar, which had failed so badly in this extreme weather event. So let's start, though, with the weather and try to help people understand a little bit better about the dynamics of weather and, more to the point, these kinds of weather events. If anyone took a look at weather maps over the last week, you saw huge widespread cold across the U.S., border to border, east to west, north to south. and especially extreme cold through the Midwest, dipping down all the way from the Canadian border to the Gulf Coast. So what caused this kind of event?
It's really quite fundamental and simple, Mark. What causes these events is the very deep accumulation and buildup of extreme cold over the high-latitude areas of the Arctic that get no sunlight this time of the year. There's ice and snow cover up there, which acts as a reflector, nearly a perfect reflector or radiator, I should say, in the infrared, causing large amounts of heat loss to space through radiation, and that causes temperatures to plummet. And, you know, as we see every single winter, the temperatures up there get extremely cold. We get readings typically that get up to as low as 80 below zero. See this in Siberia all the time and parts of Alaska. So when the cold builds up to a certain point, it causes the temperature difference between the poles and the equator to increase over time. That increases the strength of the jet stream and destabilizes it. And eventually you get these large waves, large waves in the jet that will develop that cause storms. Actually, the storm formation is the cause of the waviness. And that waviness dislodges this cold air and sends it in all directions southward around the globe. And the cold air buildup this year was so bad, so severe, it caused major outbreaks, not just here in the continental United States out of Canada, but it was doing the same thing in Europe as the Thames River froze for the first time in 58 years. But that's what the cause of it is. It has absolutely nothing to do with climate change, as these people keep trying to say that it does, that don't understand science, and some of them just openly lie about it. They should know better.
Yes. So we've talked in the past how global warming, now known as climate change, is both the cause and the scapegoat for practically any weather event. Heat in the summer, it's climate change. No snow in the winter, climate change. Too much rain, climate change. Drought, climate change. And sure enough, there was a New York Times article on Valentine's Day that effectively blamed all of this cold and ice on global warming. And there's this from that, quote, winter storms are influenced by many factors, but the planet's warming appears to be part of that icy blend, even while climate change is making winters milder overall. The air that sits over the Arctic is now sweeping down into the southern United States as a result of a weakened jet stream, which circulates around the pole and usually holds in the frigid air of the polar vortex. So it sounds like there's this giant Star Trek-type shield that keeps all that cold in. But there is evidence that planetary warming is weakening the jet stream and allowing the cold store, the cold air to escape to the south, especially when a blast of additional warming strikes its stratosphere and deforms the vortex, blah, 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 blah. And then there's this. Texas, which is known for hurricanes, is not known for snow and cold damage, such as burst water pipes, and it's not in spite of climate change, but related to climate change. So once again, global warming, aka climate change, is the boogeyman of the weather. Talk to us about how those authors get that so wrong.
It's completely wrong. This started with two authors back in 2012 who wrote a paper who said that the Arctic warming, and they call it Arctic amplification, causes the jet stream winds to weaken, and therefore the waviness to this flow pattern increases, and it drives weather extremes because the cold air gets to further south latitudes than it would otherwise without the waviness and the jet. The problem with the paper is it's complete nonsense. It's been debunked. I wrote a paper about it, and it was published on Ed Berry and also What's Up With That through Anthony Watts, that explains that the waviness in the jet stream is caused by the temperature difference between the poles and the equator. If that temperature difference decreases as it would if you were really getting this Arctic warming they're talking about, it would weaken the jet stream but also weaken the waviness because the cold air simply isn't powerful enough to penetrate southerly latitudes. It's that difference that causes the huge waves and drives the cold air to latitudes very far south from the pole. This year was a good example of that because global temperatures didn't go up, they plummeted. They dropped nearly a full half a degree over the course of the fall and into the winter season. This is allowed, and this is because cold air is building up to very intense levels in the Arctic. This increased the waviness and caused storms that drove the cold air southward. It's as simple as that. It's the exact opposite of what they claim. This science has become terribly introverted and corrupted by this global warming nonsense. And even these authors who wrote that paper were debunked by other academics. after they wrote this nonsense and making this claim. But once you get it out there, like they did way back in 2012, the lie continues to get perpetuated, and it becomes part of the narrative of these warmers who are producing this absolutely corrupt scientific nonsense that they push out to the public and that we're hearing right now about this. And they do it because they're scrambling. As temperatures plummet, which they are actually doing, they have no explanation for this. And I have made the point before, there were many low temperature records set around the globe just this last month. And the most significant, because it's a climate marker going back to the 1600s, was the freezing of the Thames River in London. That hasn't happened for 58 years. There were records broken as far south as San Antonio, Texas, just the other day that set a record that went back all the way to 1898, dropping to 14 degrees above zero. So I always say to these people that claim that the climate is warming due to CO2, if it were true that atmospheric carbon dioxide is driving the temperature and is the temperature thermostat like these complete scientific illiterates claim, then how is it with atmospheric CO2 being up to 38% higher than it was back to the date that these first temperature records were broken? How is it that they're able to repeat again if CO2 is the climate thermostat? They say, well, it gets progressively warmer. You can still get these colder years. But if you're getting temperature controlled by atmospheric CO2, it would be theoretically impossible, according to them, to assault records that old. And yet we continue to do it, which is an offer of proof by nature itself that this whole theory of theirs is complete nonsense. And it also it tries to contradict the theory from atmospheric science itself that goes back to the founding principles that said CO2 is not a driver of anything. It's of secondary significance. And the only thing that changed between those founding principles and now are failed climate models that they used to make these horrific public policy with.
Well, that, and they can also make an awful lot of money blaming CO2. So,
oh, absolutely.
All right.
This has become a money racket.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, coming up, more Chuck Weiss, an actual scientist and meteorologist. Stay with us. When we come back, we're going to dissect why all those billion-dollar computer models not only don't work, but can't work. And welcome back. We're talking with Chuck Weiss, an actual scientist with actual experience as a meteorologist. Common sense and experience, which practically eliminates him from running for one of those billion-dollar global warming marketing grants. Chuck, just like we got a little bit of clarity on weather in that last segment, I think we should try to give a little more clarity on climate change itself. It used to be global cooling, then global warming, and then it became climate change. So what exactly does the left mean when they say climate change? Isn't it just weather? And when they blame climate change for the weather, aren't they essentially blaming the weather on the weather?
Yes, exactly. They changed the narrative, Mark, because they ran out of warming. When the climate actually stopped warming for a good 15 years shortly after the year 2000, we went back to the cold phase of the Pacific Decadal Oscillation back then, and the oceans have an enormous influence on our climate. So it stopped all the warming. And then recently, for an unknown reason, because usually these things run in 30-year cycles, it went back to warm phase shortly after 2010, and we had two super El Niños back-to-back, which put a lot of heat into the atmosphere, caused the temperature to go up again and spike, and now it's plummeting. Now that that's over, and we're back into cold phase PDO with a very strong La Niña this winter. So that's the reason why they changed the narrative, because their climate models have failed. The models predict this lock-and-step rise in temperature with atmospheric CO2. And we didn't get that for 15 years. And so they changed the term to climate change, and then they start invoking all of this complete nonsense about severe weather being proof that climate change is real and we have to do something about it. These people are evil, in my opinion. They have so corrupted science, and they lie so much about things.
Yes.
There's no excuse for any of it, but it's all political.
No excuse, no excuse, and there's just no consequence either for just flat-out lying. We talked to you last night in preparation for the show, and you had mentioned that back in the 1970s, when you were at OSU pursuing your meteorology degree, they changed it to modeling. Explain to our audience that change and how that then changed climate studies going forward.
Well, back in the 1970s, I watched the atmospheric science department at Oregon State University get transformed into what they wanted to make it. And I'm not arguing with the objective of what they wanted to do. It's a noble objective to say we'd like to be able to predict the climate 100 years in advance. But there are so many limitations mathematically that go with that. I was thinking in my mind at the time they said we're going to do this, well, good luck with that, because there's been no mathematician that's known how to overcome the difficulties in pursuing this. And they persist not only in weather forecasting, but in the advent of climate models themselves. And that was their objective back then. We're going to develop climate models. We're going to be able to tell the future climate up to 100 years. That's going to be the new frontier in atmospheric science. So they went ahead and built the models, but it's okay to do that if you want to run one in a basement and say we're going to wait to see what kind of results we get from this and see what we have to do to improve upon it. But they didn't do that because the politicians wanted answers when they said they could build these models. And so the results that they first came out with were what the politicians like Al Gore wanted to hear. And if you don't produce a result that you can make public policy with, which is what they wanted to hear, the politicians, they're not going to fund you. And these people in academia knew that. So they crossed a line when they announced the results they were getting and said, we can make public policy with this sort of thing. You absolutely cannot do that, because a climate model in reality is nothing more than a weather forecast model configured for climate. And what you have to do to switch it to a climate model is you have to resize the grids that you make all of your calculations upon. And when you make the grid larger, more energy escapes that you can't track. When you make the grid smaller, which you can do with short-range weather forecasting, you improve upon your accuracy. There has never been a climate model that can run with a number of calculations that have to be done with anything more than a much larger grid size than over the ones that make short-term weather forecasts with. When you're committed to that sort of limitation, you have no way of capturing any energy processes, no way of keeping track of things with any sort of certainty. And so what they did was they knew this. So what they did was they just said, well, we're going to treat it like a boundary value problem in mathematics. We'll just let the weather run randomly. We know we're not going to get that right. But somehow, if we do that with our modeling, and because the Earth is a sphere, in the long term, things will average out and we'll be able to pull a magic rabbit out of the hat, like temperature or something like that. This is complete nonsense. They know these models don't work. They have to tweak them all the time. They're constantly reinitializing them to try to make it look like they're getting satisfactory results, but the fact of the matter is they're not. If you go back to the first times they ran them and compare the initial predictions made with temperature now, they're off by almost a factor of 3 in terms of temperature. And yet, we're using these things, and they are making claims to the public that you can rely on these results to make public policy with. And it's a disaster, a complete disaster. You can't do it. There's no way you're going to be able to do it in the near future. You're not telling the truth if you're going to say that you have accuracy that you can make public policy with. And it's also contrary to the founding principles in atmospheric science, which should have told them a long time ago, if we're getting results that CO2 is just getting this kind of warming or causing this kind of warming, there must be something wrong. Well, the mathematical limitations would give you just one hint amongst many others that are so technical, it's not, you know, we just can't go into them on the show here.
Yeah, and getting back to the fact that these long-term models not only don't work, but they can't because, as you said, they have to change the grid sizes and all that. So when they're jimming the numbers, what exactly does that mean? Do they run the model and not get the results they want, so they have to go back in and reinsert, reconfigure things? Is that essentially what they're doing?
No, they just change the open variables that are not closed. They can tweak it any number of different ways to try to get it to match the temperature, and then they don't necessarily say what they've done. For example, aerosols are one thing that they've tried to study and that they put into these models. If you increase the aerosols, you're going to get cooling. That damps the warming effect that's predicted by the model. If you decrease aerosols, you're going to get warming. The slope of the curve will change based upon how you tweak these other parameters. So what they're doing is they're just playing games. They're curve fitting to try to make it look like they're trying to match the temperature with their models and then saying they can accurately predict the future. And they can't predict the future. These things are, like I said, they're a disaster. And we've spent hundreds of billions of dollars in computing power at NOAA to try to run these climate models. And they keep thinking, well, we'll just add more computing power. This will improve our accuracy. It's not going to improve it with the size that those grids have to be to run a climate model, because if you have them too small, you make so many calculations that the computational stability will explode on you, and you don't even have a working product. So they're constantly battling that back and forth. But the point is, when you configure a weather forecast model to predict climate, you can't possibly capture anywhere close to the energy transfer flow, energy transfer formation and flow through the system to accurately get any sort of answer. Because we know in short-term weather forecasting, that's why the solutions fall apart in a matter of a day or two or three. Because even with the smaller grid sizes in weather forecast models, we lose track of energy transformation and advection through the system. And so the solutions fall apart. This is a known limitation of atmospheric science and has been for many years. And yet these people in academia are not being truthful when they say they have a working product you can make this public policy with. And then look what we have.
Yes, and that's the real danger, isn't it? Is this kind of game, supercomputer gamesmanship that forms the basis of public policies, which means we're spending hundreds of billions of dollars on a fiction, essentially. All right, let's go and take a break. We'll have more on that with Chuck Weiss after this. And welcome back in our final segment. Oh, Chuck Weiss, he's an actual scientist who uses actual science, not computer models. And Chuck, you know, in that last segment, you're talking about how they essentially reconfigure these models to get the results they want. And I can't think of any other science where you would do that and get away with calling that science. I mean, think even just in polling. If you were to insert, you know, you didn't get the results that you wanted, and so you had to insert 50 more respondents or something in order to get the results that you wanted. Or, I mean, medical science. You couldn't do that in medical science. Can you think of any other science where they just change the theoretical inputs until you get the result you want and then claim it somehow reflects the real world?
Well, it's part of the limitations of making a model. One of the difficulties, Mark, that you have in modeling even weather forecast models is that it's impossible for them to model clouds accurately. This has been a very complex problem that the modelers simply have no answer for. So what they have to do is they parameterize some of the equations that describe those processes. And by parameterizing, it means they're adding a fudge factor. It means they really don't know. So they're guessing and they play around with this stuff. And so you can put fudge factors into clouds. You can alter aerosols, which alters the amount of solar radiation coming in and reaching the ground. There's all kinds of things that they can do and that they do with these models to change them to get the answers that they want and to try to match what's going on with the temperature. But that's not science. A good model would have all the physics in it that you can just let, you know, you initialize it and you let it run. It'll give you an answer at any point in time that you seek from it. And if it's a good model, it'll give you an accurate answer. And these guys have known for a long time that their answers are way off the mark. And so they just play games to try to alter the results by playing with the open variables. And that's not real science. It's not real modeling. It's in the sense that you have a good closed system that's going to make, that understands and accurately predicts all the processes to give you an answer in climate that you're seeking.
Well,
but they do it anyway. And then
I was just going to say, and in any other science, it's testable and repeatable. So
exactly. And exactly.
Yeah, you couldn't do that with this. Yeah, it just sounds like modeling is a little better than witchcraft. And in fact, it might be a little less accurate.
Yes. Well, yeah. See, and that's the thing that's very upsetting about this, because we knew what the general answer should be just from the founding principles in atmospheric science. So you go all the way back to the inceptions that were taken up in atmospheric science post-Einstein, when radiation was quantized. And scientists like Walter L. Sasser came along that we studied the radiation physics of back in college, at OSU. And the founding principles from all of this told us that the 900-pound gorilla in the climate arena, in terms of changing the Earth's temperature, was water vapor, clouds, and the hydrological cycle, not atmospheric CO2. It was well understood back then that CO2 is only a greenhouse gas of secondary significance. It's basically along for the ride, and it doesn't have any effect to control temperature or any part of the climate. This is what the founding work that was done showed us. So when you start one of these models up, and you get these wildly diverging answers that say, oh, CO2 is causing all this warming, that should send alarm bells off on these people's heads right away and say, well, why is it converging from the founding principles? Even if you had a good working model, you'd have a problem there that you would have to look into. It could be that Walt Elsasser and people like him are wrong, but nobody has proven that he is wrong. And so you have to look at all this stuff objectively if you're a real scientist, and they haven't done this. And the politics has absolutely corrupted it, because what happened was, when Al Gore had his ambitions back in the Clinton administration to prove that his book, Earth and the Balance, was correct, he was in control of what universities got money and which ones didn't. Yeah. When he asked people to help him a long time ago, there were scientists that came forward and said, Al, you're marching down the wrong path here. I wouldn't publish your book because it's that far off the mark. Al Gore, in his absolute arrogance, got mad at these people and cut their funding off and made it clear to any other university, you don't get any money unless you agree with me. And that started the corruption in science. But the amount of money the government spends on this now is hundreds of billions of dollars with all the universities across the country per year. And now these people have been corrupted by this, and they don't want to give it up, even if they know deep down inside they're wrong. And this is a horrible thing what's happened to science over this.
Oh, absolutely. It is. You know, we only got about a minute here with you. Talking about no penalty for lying, when he was governor of the oil-rich Texas, G.W. Bush had fallen for the advice of experts and put in all these renewables, which simply didn't work when they needed it. Now the Biden administration is out there saying it was coal and gas that failed rather than these renewables. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, renewables are okay if you want to use them as some sort of a supplement to the main power grid. For example, you want to put a solar panel up to lower your electric bill because you can feed the energy grid somewhat with solar. There's nothing wrong with this. But to try to say that windmills and solar are going to substitute for what we know are very reliable and very powerful sources of electrical energy, such as hydro, nuclear, gas, those things have nowhere close to any competition by renewable energy. So to think you can substitute renewables for this and you're going to have a successful power grid is sheer lunacy. And
yes.
There's no physicist out there that would be able to show otherwise. In fact, they all know what the truth is.
Yes, they do. But unfortunately,
crazy environmentalism that's causing this. It's this notion, false notion, that keeps getting put forward that we must do this and we must reduce our CO2 emissions or we're going to destroy the planet.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's an absolute lie.
Yep, that's the problem. These bad science leads to bad policies, unfortunately. Jack, I want to thank you so much for your time today.
Well, you're quite welcome, Mark. Glad to help out.
There is a new warning from the global warming crowd. If you turn on your stove in the kitchen, it could cause snow in your living room. Okay, not really, but it does sound like something that they might say. And who knows, with a few $1 billion for marketing, maybe people would believe it. We don't have $1 billion for marketing, but we sure appreciate it when you help us spread the word. Because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.